Chapter 34. Return to Erda. I have no recollection between Ara'a and the instant I awoke in the mountains of Erda. One moment I asked Irpisha to take me home, and the next I was lying upon the rock face, feeling stiff and foggy. Sometimes I think about that and wonder if I'd really been in Ara'a. I suppose it could have been another of her simulations. I don't know. I've never asked her. She was perched upon a rock when I awoke, staring like a curious bird. I smiled as soon as I saw her face, and she smiled back, and we knew that for the moment all was well. I sat up, groaned, and slid backward until I found a rock and rested against it. Then I looked up and sighed. High above our heads was the cloud barrel, ever turning against Erda's own gyration. Somewhere up there, at the center of the funnel, the passage to hell lurked. I closed my eyes to put the moment off and asked, "How bad will the gravity be when I reach ground level?"
"Not bad at all."
I opened my eyes to see if she was toying with me. Her expression suggested she was not. Peering closely, I scooped up a palmful of debris from the outcrop and scoured my palms with it.
"We're really here?"
"Of course. Why would you even ask?"
I gave her a look that she then returned, and I think we both silently agreed not to pursue the issue. I had not yet learned to step inside her mind at this point, and ever since I discovered how, I refused to do it. It is a true axiom that our predecessors are excellent models of behavior, both for what should and should not be repeated. I breathed in deeply, let it out.
"The air is different here."
"Oh?"
"Mm-hmm. I can smell it. It's sweet, like some kind of perfume."
"Perfume is a superficial covering," she said.
She seemed disinterested in the subject.
"The same could be said for this world."
Now I felt all of her looking at me.
"Such statements do not ease a goddess mother's heart."
"Be at ease," I assured her. "I have no desire to upset these people's lives. Much."
"Udo, Irpisha,
am I to be a god?"
"You are."
"Then trust in your god."
She leaned forward, suddenly intent.
"You don't sound like yourself."
I stood, relishing the strength in my legs. I felt as though I could leap from the mountainside and land gently in the grass fields far below.
"I don't feel like myself. Already little details of this world and her twin parade through my mind. Would you like to know the outer diameter of the pressure vessel?"
"Udo, I already..."
25 miles, which is, of course, slightly off from the Erden Mila, which is itself a derivative of the earthbound Wiesbaden Mila, at 1,000 meters or 3,281 feet.
"Udo?"
"Yes?"
"Are you well now?"
"Getting there. Why do I know these things so easily?"
She rose from the rock and came to stand beside me. We looked out over the expanse of the sleeping world together, she thinking her own inscrutable thoughts while I searched for familiar landmarks.
"You've had time to integrate much of the information you've attained. Also, I put you into a special chassis. There's an active airbound link to your core right now, dutifully cataloging all that you see and hear, but at the same time you are able to draw information back to yourself."
"You're offloading my memories?" I asked, a little disturbed.
"No, that's far too much information for the medium. This is limited to images and sounds, something you'd be able to play back later on if you forgot what happened. It would be like viewing events as they happened to someone else."
I retracted the melam to examine the backs of my hands. The diamonds were still there, of course.
"Why?" I asked.
"Because you've tried to do this twice already and keep getting yourself killed."
"I what? I remember none of this."
"Yes, I'm aware. Earlier chassis lacked an active link. Bringing you back up to speed twice is about as far as I'll go, assuming you persist on this path. If you get yourself terminated again, you'll be able to brief yourself the next time around.
Chassis, chassis, I muttered, searching. Then, body. You mean my body? I looked down at my hands again, now very closely. Every line and wrinkle was correct, down to the scars crossing along the knuckles. How many of these are there?
As many as are needed. Once the blueprint is established, it is easy to construct more.
I thought about that. Blueprint. Why would it be blue?
Never mind.
All right, I said, and returned my attention to Erda. There was a crispness on the air, a dampened cold that tasted of morning. I looked along the tube, feeling as though I sighted through my own personal erdoscope. Somewhere along the line was the grand city of Colmar, the Theodiscan capital. Somewhere in all that green, I muttered. I thought I could detect a thin band of blue along the center, the Mittlera, but the distance was much to overcome. I strained to see more, and suddenly all of Colmar was laid at my feet as if I flew above her walls like Thunair. Then I realized I was Thunair. And not only him, I was Nosuna and Zintgunt, Siksneet, Frigg, Tyr the One-Handed, and Hel. I was the embodiment of the High Nine, save for Godon himself, who had yet to be dealt with, and Ing, my mother goddess and future queen. I looked down on the city, her many districts and canals, saw the first merchants pulling their carts out to the street sides, saw established tradesmen opening the windows and doors to their shops as their families bustled about upstairs in the living quarters. Bleary-eyed men staggered from taverns to walk crook-legged down the alleys searching out beds or jobs. Many of them stumbled right off the stoops and onto the docks where fishermen too poor to afford a skiff cast their lines hopefully. Out in the bay, ships laden with nets pulled past the breakwater towers in search of hardy schools. The entirety of Colmar yawned below me, the many animals and scurrying children, the criers peppering every street corner shouting each other down, guardsmen marching their patrols, rubbishmen pulling their carts, filling their carts with jar after jar of refuse, blast of horns, clop of hooves, the newborn wail of the waking city. I turned from this sight to the throne of Sunna, suspended upon the heartstrings, my throne. Suddenly, I was looking into my own eyes reflected back upon me, a reflection cast against a reflection repeating backward to infinity, a procession of Udos stretching back in an infinite line, wrapping upon itself. I reached toward them, and they, with a forest of uplifted hands, reached back for me in perfect synchronization. I staggered backward into her arms, feeling as though I was falling again. She was holding me tightly and shushing into my ear. I realized I was raving madly and shut my mouth. A moment later, she'd sat me down upon a boulder and wrapped an arm around my waist as if fearful that I would start up again.
All right, she asked.
I'd cast myself out into the world somehow. I was above Colmar, flying like a raven almost.
You probably were a raven.
I glanced at her. Really? She shrugged and nodded toward the open sky.
Some of the birds up there are a bit more than flesh and bone.
I nodded. Of course.
And ravens are among the most intelligent birds ever to have existed. They're a good match.
I got it.
You grew dizzy? From the flying?
No, I said. I felt the heat of the sun on my back, but would not turn around. I looked at the core, and some very odd things happened.
Oh,
laughed Irpisha. She shook her head, gave me a pat on the back, and then released me.
Well, that makes sense. You were staring into yourself, your prime self.
I don't understand.
She stood, faced southward, and pointed. That's where you truly are, up in that core. This body you're riding right now, that's all it is. A shell. It's time to start thinking like a god now, Udo. It's like a human dream wearing these bodies. When you used to sleep, were you aware of your physical form in the dream?
No, or not really.
Ah, But if you became aware, what happened?
The dream ended. Often I would simply wake up.
Yes, she agreed, and nodded toward the sun. It's safe for you to look on the sun with these eyes. Nothing at all will happen. But if you displace yourself further, as you did with the raven, and then look upon yourself, it creates a rather nasty feedback loop.
I shook my head vigorously to clear off the remaining shreds of disorientation. I'll keep that in mind.
Yes, just make sure you keep it in the right one, she giggled.
I ignored the jest. Instead, I said, This is where we met. It was not a question.
Yes. How do you remember that day?
Fondly. I heard a sigh. I was not looking at her. You fear I'll grow to hate you, I said.
I do.
I could not.
I wonder.
If I do not hate myself, I could scarcely hate you. I used to hate myself, I think, despised myself. But I'm not exactly feeling myself lately.
She agreed. Could it be that you're only now beginning to feel
enough? I sighed and stood. I turned around to face the world, stared down the sun until the light dimmed, then with a wink, brightened it back up again and said, We're running in philosophical circles. It's a pursuit that is perhaps interesting as a mental exercise, but lacks significance in a practical environment. It is time for some action now.
It sounds like you've come to a decision.
Yes, perhaps more than once, according to you. Where shall I meet you when I'm finished?
You already know.
Yes, I suppose I do.
I felt her retreating away, a warm presence fading.
Wait, I said. This Melam, it will disturb them.
We've had this conversation before. You'll find the solution at the foot of the mountain. Our children have placed it there.
I dipped my head. As always, you are phenomenal.
I know, her voice smiled.
Then she was gone.
I found the robes at the mountain foot, as she'd said. They'd been folded and laid upon a rock not far away from where I'd first encountered Risa. The clothing consisted of two parts. A dark gray frock, such as what our priests wore during religious gatherings, and a black hooded cape to wear over it. She also provided an exceptional pair of supple boots with thick leather soles, something quite uncommon for the time and place. I considered leaving them. They were unnecessary, strictly speaking. But looking at the strangeness of my feet, I decided they were better off hidden away. I donned and fiddled with these garments until they were comfortable, speaking to Irpisha while doing so on the assumption that she could hear, or at least would at some future time, hear me.
The connotation of this clothing is not lost on me, I'll have you know, I said, slipping wooden toggles through the leather loops at my breast. Nor the place you left it. I think this is something we must discuss later. Your sense of humor is quite wicked. Assuming this is humor. Am I being chided again? Are you reminding me from whence I came?
Abruptly, I ceased speaking and looked at my hands, flexed them into fists, and relaxed them. I realized I was no longer thinking of myself as me, or rather, when I thought of my own personality, the name Udo was not to be found among my musings. On a whim, I relaxed my hold on the Melam, and allowed it to ooze forward until hands and fingers were fully encapsulated. I flexed the fingers and rotated the appendages, fascinated. Then I retracted the dark skin and looked again on pink flesh, battered nails, hair, scars. I flexed the fingers and rotated the appendages, still fascinated.
These aren't mine, I whispered.
And so they were not. They seemed to me the hands of a stranger. I spent a few moments touching my thumbs to the tips of each finger in rapid succession, wondering if there would be any limitations to their use, but as far as I could tell, there were none. Still, it felt less like I was using my hands and more like I was manipulating some complex network of machinery that controlled someone else's hands. Another wave of vertigo took me then,
and I stumbled to a nearby rock to sit down.
You know, the night still comes at the same time here. You should think about finding some shelter before that happens.
Her voice came from a hidden place directly behind my skull. I wondered if you were still here, I said. Don't trust me out and about on my own, eh?
Just trying to save time. I supposed that if you were going to persist in being reckless, I could at least be there to give a warning.
Reckless? Exactly what did I do?
I'd rather not say. You might try it again out of sheer stubbornness.
Fine, have it your way. Is there anything wrong with my body?
Dizzy?
Yes.
No, it's you, not the body. You're beginning to dissociate.
I don't understand that word.
You will soon. Your mind is in the process of remapping itself at this very moment. Not the apparatus you're carrying around in that flesh suit now. Your true mind. There is a lot of new information to synthesize. For a while, you're going to feel as though there are two of you, which can be disturbing. Just ride it out and tell yourself it will eventually be over, and when it is over, only one of you will remain.
But which one?
It will still be you, essentially. Udo, you have to realize that the sum total of all recorded knowledge, both human and God, has been transferred into your consciousness. There is simply no way to pass through such an experience unchanged.
Huh, I grunted, pulling on the cape. As I tied it around my neck, I said, I'm not sure you should continue to call me by that name. It does not feel like me.
How shall I call you?
You needn't call me anything. You are inside my head. Simply speak and I'll have a good idea who you're speaking to.
The music of her laughter accompanied my first southbound steps. Suno was beautiful that morning. I left the hood down and breathed in the air. It tasted of wet grass and pollen and rich soil and the clean waters of the far-off Ruhr. The boots upon my feet fit marvelously, and the melam was such that even in heavy robes I was quite comfortable. As I crossed the field, plunged past the tree line, and found the overgrown remnants of my old trail, I laughed.
What's funny?
Nothing you'd understand. Let me be a while, please.
As you will. But there's one final thing before I fade to the background.
Yes?
There is a pocket sewn inside the left breast of your cape. Search it out.
I did. My hands contacted something smooth, cold, and hard, about the length and width of my thumb, but thin as a knife blade. I took the item from my pocket and examined it. Rectangular metal, rounded corners, polished to a mirror finish. As I held it, I realized it had already warmed to my body temperature.
Interesting, I said. It reminds me of Triangle. What is this?
A multi-tool,
she smiled.
Uh-huh. Seems a simple piece of rather fine steel.
You tell it what you'd like for it to do.
I looked around as I walked. The forest was thick, and though it still felt to me like the Arnsborg, I realized I could no longer recognize individual trees as I once had. I put it all down to what was happening within my mind and returned my attention to the tool.
Oh, tool! I have places to be. Become an airplane!
I heard something like a snort.
That's not how it works.
Well, you said...
Does it seem like there's enough material there to form an airplane?
Perhaps. A very small one, perhaps.
Cute. Try something useful now.
Oh, an airplane would be very useful.
Yes, to kill yourself yet again, exceedingly useful. And you don't speak to it. Command it like you would your own hand.
Ah.
I concentrated on the little piece of metal, but could not sense it in any way.
Something's wrong. I don't feel it.
You're still wearing the melam.
Yes, under the clothes you gave me.
And the melam is in contact with the tool?
Oh, I thought it was airbound.
No, the principle of the material doesn't support inner workings. It requires a kinetic link.
Understood, I said. I let the second skin englove my hand. It was an odd sensation when it slithered between the pads of my fingers and the metal, like trying to grasp a fresh-caught fish with plenty of fight left in its heart. It wanted to slip out of my fingers. When the black material touched the metal, I was acutely aware of its presence, as I was acutely aware of the melam. It was as though I'd suddenly grown a sixth finger and knew precisely how to use it. As I looked on, it lengthened out to a long spike, needle-thin and disturbingly deadly. When I relaxed my desire, it deformed back to a simple bar. You know, I was about to complain that a dagger or a satchel of some sort would have been preferred, but I'm starting to understand the benefits of this.
I'm glad you approve.
I do, thank you. Was there anything else you'd like to share?
Yes. Please don't die.
I laughed. I'll see what I can do. I thought about leaving the melam over my hands, hoping it might pass for gloves, but it still fluctuated wildly in color whenever it contacted an outside surface, and I didn't know how to make it stop, thinking don't do that to the material had no impact at all. After a moment's thought, I retracted the melam back to my wrist and then slipped the tool in between the skins there. Then I experimented with it as I walked, passing it like liquid up my arm, across the chest, and into the palm of my other hand. On a whim, I separated it into two parts and deposited them at either wrist, held up my hands, and watched as dual needles stretched along my palms. Smiling, I retracted them back into the sleeves and continued on.